Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour this year. We have a holiday treat, a preview of Invisibilia, NPR's newest show. Invisibilia looks at the invisible forces that shape human behavior, like the impulse to put things into categories or the meaning of dark thoughts. From the people who created This American Life and Radiolab, look for Invisibilia on iTunes under podcasts. Subscribe and be the first to hear full episodes of Invisibilia on January 9th. Listen. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, the film adaptation of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods, starring Meryl Streep, Anna Kendrick, Emily Blunt, and a cast of princes and stepsisters. Then, as we complete another year heavily dominated by films that are part of multi-chapter franchises, we'll consider what makes for a successful franchise and why some just can't get off the ground. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week as we wrap up 2014 is our friend Bob Mondello. Bob Mondello, what do you do at NPR?
I review movies for NPR.
Well, you know, Bob was a great choice for this show, I felt, because Bob, like me and like Glenn, is a big lover of the Sondheim musical Into the Woods. Mm-hmm. Stephen knew nothing.
This, you could have told me this movie was about absolutely anything. I knew nothing.
Yeah.
Stephen, which is kind of embarrassing because it's a big famous play.
Tree surgery. It's about tree surgery.
Stephen came in cold, but Glenn and Bob and I all have a special attachment to this show. Is that fair to say, guys?
It is, but oh, yeah. Bob is not just a movie critic. He is also a theater critic.
Uh-huh.
So he strides these two things like a colossus.
Yeah, right. I am actually in the position. This is unnerving to me because I have so often told people who are nuts about the novel that they read that is turning into a movie that they don't think is any good, that they have to let go of the novel. And I'm in the same position exactly on this one because I love this show so much and I know its beats and I know
right.
how it's supposed to be.
Right.
And I wanted to do that in the film, and of course it can't do that in the film.
Right. And for those of you who aren't familiar with this show, it premiered on Broadway in 1987. It ran there for almost 2 years. It has, you know, been revived in a whole bunch of different places as recently as a couple of years ago in New York as part of Shakespeare in the Park, despite the fact that it's not Shakespeare. It is essentially a fairy tale itself, complete with a once upon a time beginning and a happily ever after ending. And it interweaves really four classic fairy tales, Cinderella, Rapunzel, Little Red Riding Hood, and Jack and the Beanstalk, into a new story about wishes coming true and then having consequences. And on stage, it's divided into two acts. The first takes you up to those fairy tale endings, and then the second really considers what happens when those endings become complicated.
Now, they've been trying to make this play into a movie for more than 20 years now.
Yeah, I think there have been a bunch of abortive attempts.
There was going to be Robin Williams was going to be in it at one point. Billy Crystal was going to be the baker at one point.
Oh,
so it's taken a really, really long time for people to figure out how to adapt this play.
Yeah. For those of you who are familiar with the show, there are some emotional beats, I think, removed from the second act.
Mm-hmm. Right. There is some thematic underlining of certain relationships. You spend a lot of more time on the abandoned father issues, I think. There's just more dialogue devoted to that in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
No, actually here.
Oh, here.
Well,
dialogue devoted to it, not a song. There's some theatrical gambits were abandoned. The framing device is tweaked here as well. But mostly what I noticed about the movie was it's movie stars on parade. So it's kind of like when you see Cold Mountain and every character is a movie star and it's like, oh, there's her again. Here, some of them work, some of them don't. I didn't really jibe with what Johnny Depp was putting down because he just seems like Johnny Depp. He plays the wolf, which is a very important part in both shows. He plays the wolf as if he's Johnny Depp who just got away from brunch at the Ivy in L.A.
No, it's
right?
true. He's doing a very, very piratey wolf.
But he swapped one dumb hat for another dumb hat. You know that pickup artist Mystery? It's like if Mystery were a furry, That's what we get.
Oh, my gosh.
But, Linda, you had a really interesting point about this when we were talking about it the other day, about how it's not really him that is different from what was on stage. It's her.
Yeah.
It's Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah. Little Red Riding Hood and Jack from Jack and the Beanstalk. In the stage show, they both play like teenagers.
Right.
In the movie, they play much more like tweens, I would say. Mm-hmm. And it's a subtle difference. I mean, the girl who played Little Red Riding Hood on Broadway was only like 15 or 16. She wasn't an adult. Mm-hmm. The girl playing her here is like 13 or was like 13-ish when they filmed it.
And they originally cast someone even younger.
Right. But the difference is profound. The scene between the wolf and Little Red Riding Hood is in the stage play a very overt kind of sexual metaphor, where the wolf is talking about devouring her and he's going to gobble her up. But the wolf on stage is wearing this gigantic kind of comical cod piece that is meant to kind of make that so overt that it's kind of comedic.
Right.
And for me, it was hard to put my finger on what creeped me out about this so much. And it is because she's younger. But in the stage show, what I got was the text is him talking about food. And the subtext is all the sex stuff. Johnny Depp, to me, is playing the sex stuff as text.
Right. Yep.
Think of those crisp, aging bones. Then something fresh on the palate. Think of that scrumptious carnality twice in one day. There's no possible way to describe what you feel when you're talking to your meal.
For that reason, I just recoiled from it, and I really wanted it to be over. Mm-hmm. I was very eager for that to be done.
Now, look how different it is when you're dealing with Jack, because if you play him as a teenager, he's got to be a really dumb one to make the lyrics work. Yeah. And in this case, this is a little boy you're watching, and he doesn't have to be dumb. He just has to be a little uninformed. I mean, he's a more, I think he's actually a more interesting character because of it. And when he goes up and he acts like a little kid does, terrible things happen as a result of that, because that's what happens.
Right, right.
Yeah. I know this musical pretty well. You know, I had friends who went to see it on Broadway when it opened in 87, 89. They came away from it saying, listen, if you see it, just walk out at intermission, because the second act is so depressing. I thought that they knew what the hell that we were talking about. And of course they didn't. They're idiots. Of course. The whole point is what happens after Happy Ever After. I also saw the public theater version in 2012 in Shakespeare in the Park, the Delacorte Theater, which was with Amy Adams, Donna Murphy, and Dennis O'Hare, among other folks. But I also own the DVD of that original Broadway production. Mm-hmm. And that gets worn out. I don't consider myself a theater queen, but there's one buried about 5 or 6 drinks in. And so when we come back from a long night, sometimes it ends up in the player, and sometimes I don't go to bed until 3. Compared to that classic production, a very conservative interpretation. They don't take a lot of risks. They don't make a lot of different choices. So I found myself really liking the choices, the subtle choices that they made that were different. There are visuals that you can't get in the theater. The scene where Red Riding Hood actually goes into the woods is a very deeply Freudian scene. There's a choice made during the song on the steps of the palace where, not to spoil anything, but it's just a different choice. It's treated differently.
And that's Cinderella talking about her experience at the ball.
But one thing you always get from every production I've ever seen is this sense of interaction, of all these things happening at the same time. The song underlines that by having everybody kind of jump in at different times. The songs do that. Here, we cut away every time to a different scene, and it felt choppier to me. And there's no real way to get around that, I suppose. There are certain scenes in the film where we see them all on screen at the same time, kind of going through the woods, and that's kind of gives you, that echoes the feeling of the stage play. I did miss that. I did miss that feeling of cohesiveness.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Stephen, how did you receive this as somebody who didn't know the show going in?
Yeah, like we said, I went in cold, and I think I've said before on this show that I'm not always the first person to really, really attach to musicals. I love You're Singing in the Rain, but when you get to, you know, that Les Miserables movie that we talked about endlessly on this on this show, that was just a big, creamy, Oscars-y dollop of not for me. This I found easier to attach to, in part because it's as much a Disney musical as a stage musical. It has the stamp of Disney on it. And so for me, as a complete outsider to this story and really to movie musicals of recent vintage, I found it easier to get into it. And it's stuck with me a little bit. I think there are a few things I'd have done differently. I had the same reaction Linda did to the Johnny Depp as the Big Bad Wolf. And to have it kind of played for laughs made it even more so. As people have said, there's a gigantic tonal shift directly in the middle of this movie. And for a while, I think it takes the film a bit to find its footing and get back to where it needs to be. But along the way, I mean, Stephen Sondheim can write the holy living hell out of a song. And there were several songs that I'd heard on the wind, you know, in the past, but never in their full context. And a song like No One Is Alone, I just loved that song and really seized on it and have been letting it rattle around my head ever since, how many layers there are to that song and how beautiful that song is.
Yeah. The thing that struck both you and me, Linda, before going in to see the film, we were talking about it, and you mentioned how wise this show is in many different ways. And it's not just the songs. James Lapine doesn't get the attention he deserves for structuring this thing the way he does. I've watched it so many times that I kind of like think about it as just songs. But seeing it in this context made me realize how well you could bounce a quarter off of this plot. That's the whole idea. Everything is tied together. Everything happens because one thing happens, and all the consequences literally are just building. And there's even a song about it at the end where people are blaming each other for exactly what goes wrong. And that's
also a great song.
Which I think I heard all the lyrics of for the first time.
It's supposed to be faster. Yeah. It was too slow.
That's right.
Maybe that's why I heard them all the first time. I get such a kick out of watching things when they're working. And in this particular case, I got a kick out of watching things when they were different. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about Agony for a second?
Oh, God, yes. And we have to talk about Chris Pine.
Oh, yeah. My God. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm thinking of him as Captain Kirk. He comes on and he's got sort of a 3-day shadow. And he comes
5-inch tall hair.
And Prince is charming. Sing a song on a waterfall.
Did I abuse her or show her disdain? Why does she run from me? If I should lose her, how shall I regain the heart she has won from me? Agony beyond power of speech. When the one thing you want is the only thing out of your reach.
It took me a while to figure out who he was. And I was like cataloging through my head, is that, that's not Zac Efron? Who is he? Like, because people kind of laughed when you see his face. And I'm like, is he an 80s soap opera star? I can't figure out who he is. And he is delightful. It's such a big, chewy part. Yep. I mean, ultimately, they sing Agony on a waterfall. How could it not be a big, chewy part?
And one of the things I really like about that scene is, and obviously Into the Woods can be staged lots of different ways, but I am most familiar with the same one Glenn was talking about, the production that was done for PBS in 1991. They essentially reunited the original Broadway cast, which some of them had gone off by then, but they brought them back. Bernadette Peters as the witch, who had only originally been with it for like, I think about 6 months and then had gone off to do other stuff, but they brought everybody back and they filmed this production that aired on PBS. Boy, talk about the uses of public television. I will tell you right now, without public television, that they would probably not be kicking around out there.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. In that production, the stage is very sparse. Mm-hmm. The stage is very simple. They put very little out there. They suggest sort of trees and woods and things like that, but you get a lot of empty, relatively empty stage. And so what you get with Agony is mostly two dudes on an empty stage. And so it's all sold with the song itself. And one of the things I really like about the film is that in certain places, I think On the Steps of the Palace is like this, and I think Agony is even more like this, they actually gave some thought to what can we add to this?
Right.
Not just how can we satisfy people who want it to be the same, and not just how can we fancy it up, but what can we actually add because we're making a movie instead of a stage show? What do we have the opportunity to add? And so often when you get that, you get something really dumb, like an unnecessary production number outside,
right,
where it's sort of like, well, yeah, you got a lot of people dancing outside, but it's not really any better than people dancing on stage, and you're not really doing anything special. Whereas with this number performed this way in this setting has some things going for it that you can't get from stage necessarily.
And especially when you're looking at this particular, all the talk surrounding this movie is like, what did they change? What did they take out?
What did they take out?
What is missing? What they're going to have to cut this down. They're going to have to narrow it. I mean, it's funny how you have to narrow a stage production to fit within the confines of a movie, which is, you know, by definition, a much broader medium. But I totally agree with you. Having not seen the play, the flourishes that could only be in a movie really worked.
Right. Yeah. Both James Lapine and Stephen Sondheim, when they came up with this production, had read a book called The Uses of Enchantment by Bruno Bettelheim, which we've talked about, we mentioned on the show before, which is about the uses of fairy tale, what fairy tales give to kids. And of course, what they give to kids is not just that there are monsters in the world, but crucially, what they tell kids is everybody faces the same monsters, that no one is alone in a sense. And also that you are gifted by your life with the things you need to overcome them. Loyalty, honesty, faith, all these things are all you need. It's within you to fight the monsters. And so everybody in this show has a moment where they say, in different ways, I learned something now that I didn't know before.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's what the show desperately needs. And when there was a rumor out there that a song called Moments in the Woods, sung by the baker's wife, was going to be cut, there was apoplexy.
Right.
It was just, you can't do that. A, because it's well known because of Joanna Gleason's performance in that DVD, that very famous production, but also because it's central. It's hugely important. And when the thought that this was going to be Disneyfied to the extent that a song like that would be removed, it's in the show, people.
Yeah. No, and well, Mr. Sondheim led to that because he talked to some...
He said it first.
Yeah, that's true.
And so everybody was nervous, and it turned out it wasn't true.
This is all fan fiction. Sure. Understand. This is all my Sondheim fan fiction. But what I imagine is him having an argument and they don't believe him that people will care if this is missing. Because there are other things that are missing from the film that are in the musical that are sort of precious to me that I do miss. There's a song that the baker's wife has about the compromises that you make to get the things that you want that I think is important to the payoff later that they don't include. And one of the things I was saying to Stephen is that one of the things I love about it, and No One Is Alone is a perfect example of this, is that that song is both very comforting. It's very much a caution.
Absolutely.
It's saying not just no one is alone, so don't worry, but also no one is alone, so be careful what you do because everything that you do affects other people. And when somebody says to you, you are part of something bigger and you are connected to others, this is a story that is wise enough to say, that doesn't just mean, you know, they're there, everyone cares about you, you're not in this by yourself, but also you better watch out because people get hurt by things that other people do, and then you have to kind of work your way through that. What did you think, Bob, of Ms. Meryl Streep as the witch?
Well, I liked her a lot. I know she can sing, and we keep forgetting that. I mean, she's shown us often enough. I liked what she did for the most part. I didn't feel as if she... I have a crush on Bernadette Peters, but I thought what she did was quite nice. I did think they gave her strange shoulders all the way through it. The costumes were weird for her, but I thought she was quite good. The one I came away with thinking was really wonderful was Emily Blunt.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Emily Blunt is playing the baker's wife is really... I thought it was great, too. I thought she was the one who came away kind of the best served by the dramatic part of the acting, although the baker is played by James Corden, who is about to take over for Craig Ferguson. I think it's a very successful adaptation, and I walked out, and Glenn and I kind of said, well, for the most part, it's the show. Yeah. It's not everything. There are pieces taken out, but for the most part, it's the show. I'm sure that a lot of you are likely to see this movie and have ideas of your own. I would love to hear from you. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. The other thing we were going to talk about this week is the franchise. Now, I was looking today at the top 10 of the year as of early December, which was the last information that I could get. Here are the top 10 of the year as of right now, which I suspect are pretty accurate for the year as a whole. The top 10 were Guardians of the Galaxy, Captain America, The Winter Soldier, The Lego Movie, Transformers, Age of Extinction, Maleficent, X-Men, Days of Future Past, The Hunger Games, Mockingjay Part 1, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, The Amazing Spider-Man 2, and Godzilla.
There are so many colons in there that it sounded like about 19 movies.
And not only that, but number 11 is 22 Jump Street, and number 12 is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and number 13 is How to Train Your Dragon 2.
Oh my God.
The only one I think does not have a greenlit sequel or is not already a sequel is Maleficent, which has had a couple of discussions about whether could there be a sequel. Right.
And in fairness, it comes out of Sleeping Beauty.
And it's exactly right. So, it's already coming out of something else. So the ones that make the big bucks, my point is, are the franchise movies. Mm-hmm. And you have to sort of get down to kind of like Gone Girl. I mean, that's sort of the biggest grossing movie of the year that isn't a franchise, a part of a franchise. So we thought it was a good time to talk about the franchise. Now, one of the things that I was thinking about was that when Bob and I were talking about The Equalizer with Denzel Washington a few weeks ago, Bob said he saw that movie and figured that the plan was a franchise with Denzel Washington as The Equalizer, partly because I assume of the ending where he is advertising his services to people who might want a wrong
An equalizer?
To be righted. Is that
No, it absolutely felt like they were ending that picture in order to set up a sequel. I mean, you can totally understand why Hollywood does this, because sequels are so lucrative now. They've learned to merchandise them. I mean, when the Harry Potter movies, for instance, make almost $1 billion each worldwide, of course you turn a 7-part series into an 8-part series. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, why wouldn't you do that?
It's interesting because I'm thinking there's a difference between a franchise that starts out with a set amount of material, right? Like the Harry Potter books. Mm-hmm. And then you make enough movies to finish that material, whether you split up the last book or not. That's one kind of franchise. And then something like Marvel movies is a different kind of franchise.
Right, right.
And then there's a third kind of franchise that's like the Fast and Furious thing, where it's so successful that you just kind of keep making them until you don't make them anymore.
Yeah, you make a sequel because a movie, a freestanding movie, was a gigantic
like
hit.
Police Academy deliberately left open-ended enough to do a sequel.
But, you know, even animated movies fall into this category where all of a sudden, like, okay, people went to Despicable Me. Now we're going to do Despicable Me 2.
It seems like Fast and Furious is one of the most recent examples I can think of just a studio throwing something out and going, like they used to do. They used to, in the 80s, they made a film called Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins. Like, so, making the
subtext.
And nobody went to that Fred Ward, Joel Grey vehicle. Go figure. But that was back then, they used to throw things out. Buckaroo Banzai, they threw out. Mm-hmm. Like, that is built to be a franchise. It is. They set up the characters, they set up the conflicts, and then they're like, this guy could be an endless series of adventures.
What was that? I Am Number 4?
Exactly. That's another one. That's more recent. Master and Commander, that series, the Horatio Hornblower series. Now, what that had that some of these other things didn't have was a pre-existing property of novels. So that's what we are now. Cross-platform synergy. This whole thing is churned by having access to all these different other media that feed into the movie. For a lot of quote-unquote comic book films, they're comic book films because they're based on a comic that exists to be essentially the storyboard for a movie.
Right.
There's entire comic book publishers who aren't really in the business of making comics that people are going to love. They're in the business for claiming the intellectual property so that it will become a movie. And that's where we are now.
Yeah.
Master and Commander is an interesting example because so many of the lists, if you go over lists of like attempted franchises that weren't, you know, Speed Racer or Green Lantern or whatever, Master and Commander is a rare exception in there in that that was an enormously well-received movie. That movie was nominated for Best Picture. And as I recall, there were people who were predicting it was going to win. It lost to the Lord of the Rings, the final segment in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, speaking of franchises. But that's a rare case of one where, like, there kind of should have been franchises. People thought there were going to be franchises, and then the movie just didn't make enough money.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think, like, what we mean when we say franchise, because, you know, a lot of people think of, like, the Avengers movies, but does that include the entire Marvel universe? The entire Marvel universe, which everyone understands not to really include Spider-Man. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Like,
Or X-Men. It's almost like one of those, they talk about like those giant moss organisms where like it's it's a giant thing of moss, but it's all one thing. And so it's like the Marvel universe or one of those things can grow out and become like a franchise of franchises.
It's a rat king.
As opposed to something like Star Wars, which at least is just one thing, is just one series. And the spinning off of franchises by other franchises is something that I suspect we're going to see more and more of. Yeah. But it's one of the reasons why I think people retain affection sometimes for things like James Bond, which announced earlier this month that they're going to have Spectre, the new James Bond movie. It was going to be your fourth Daniel Craig James Bond movie. I mean, James Bond movies are just, they just kind of keep making them mm-hmm. as long as people keep going to them. And when people stop going to, it's like Saturday Night Live. When people stop going, they change them up and yeah. keep mm-hmm. making them.
Exactly.
Nobody assumes that you're out of interest in Bond movies.
Right.
You know?
The Narnia films, I was convinced, were over. There were three of them, and they were all just huge and noisy and based on beloved books. Mm-hmm. And we've had three, and I was convinced that because the returns on them kept going down and down and down, Dawn Treader made the least of all three by a large margin, that they were over. But Silver Chair is not necessarily in production yet, but they're writing the script.
They're
doing all that kind of stuff.
I thought that was a biopic about the band.
I was convinced it was over, but it's not. And that's what I was trying to figure out. Like, why? Why do some keep going? Now, those have at their center four kids. Kids grow up very quickly, mm-hmm. too quickly for this series, for those kids to be the same age that they need to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we'll see.
Look at Ender's Game, which mm-hmm. I thought was a pretty well put together movie and was largely noisy and all of those things and seemed to have the elements that would lead naturally to sequels. And as far as I know, they're not taking that anywhere.
No, right? It didn't do very well.
Yeah.
It grossly underperformed. And that was a movie that a rare case among these movies that we're talking about where I felt like it was massively blitzkrieg advertised. Mm-hmm. I felt like I saw ads for Ender's Game for months and months and months to the point where I felt like they're just going to successfully shove this down my throat whether I want to see it or not. Yeah. And yet, when it came out, Anchorman 2 was a little like that too, mm-hmm. where you just assume because you can't get away from it that it's going to be gigantic and then like...
Yeah,
and I think the worst thing these movies can be is mediocre. Mm-hmm. That if it's just kind of boring and forgettable, nobody's talking about it. You know, that's the hardest thing to overcome.
Yeah, well, and I also think one thing that happened with fantasy franchises for a while was that in the wake of Harry Potter in particular, I felt like we were getting a lot of what felt like it was marketed to be like, did you like Harry Potter?
Right.
And they were all kind of fantasy kids, sort of YA, but maybe a little younger fantasy kids series.
Yeah, the Percy Jackson series.
Yeah, and so I feel like one thing that sometimes happens is that if one franchise is still going strong, it's harder to launch a bunch of other ones. Yeah. Now, the exception to that is obviously Divergent, which feels in the films and especially in the marketing very much inspired by Hunger Games. Right. Although the books, according to our friend Kat Chow, who's read more of the books than I have, you know, they have their own things that they're about, but marketing-wise, it feels like a Hunger Games thing, and yet that's been successful. The one that I was thinking about earlier today when I was thinking about James Bond, Madea.
Oh, mm-hmm. yeah.
Those movies have made a honk ton of money, yep. and they just make more and more and more of them. Madea is kind of like the Ernest.
For a moment there, I was thinking Greek theater. Yeah.
I immediately thought of
she's the Ernest goes to jail, goes to camp of her time.
Ernest Scared Stupid.
Ernest mm-hmm. Scared Stupid.
I don't know how we go from Madea and Ernest to John Carter, mm-hmm. but have you guys read about this, that Andrew Stanton, who directed John Carter, which is one of the biggest money-losing movies of all time, even though it has very, very, very passionate defenders, that he is like still trying to make a sequel?
I wish him luck.
Yeah, just picture him like in his garage with like puppets still trying to, like his Taylor Kitsch puppet trying to continue telling the story.
Indistinguishable from Taylor Kitsch.
I was going to say, actually, Taylor Kitsch is free. So
listen, made out of a potato.
It's totally worth mentioning that Lord of the Rings was originally an animated picture, right? Mm-hmm. There was a little animated picture, and it was not a terrible animated picture, but it certainly didn't do anything like the business.
There was the television special, The Hobbit, and then Lord of the Rings was a Ralph Bakshi film. Is that the one you're talking about?
That's the one I'm talking about. Maybe I'm not remembering it after all these years.
When I was eight, my mom took me to the Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings, and I turned my coat around backwards so that my hood covered my face.
Yeah. You love that story, Thompson.
Terrible.
I've never really topped that as a statement of criticism.
Yeah. Well, here's the last thing that I kind of want to bring up is, how do you know when to quit your franchise? You know, assuming you're not dealing with like a neat thing like Star Wars, where they have said there's only so much there's supposed to be nine of them, although my guess is they'll make them as long as they want. Yeah. How do you know when the right moment is Like, have you ever seen a franchise get to a point where you're like, okay, that's one too many movies?
X-Men The Last Stand was, I think, no, I don't know about, you can never say universally, but universally reviled. It was just a huge disappointment from the first two. And that made the field go fallow for a good long time, and nothing could grow, and they salted the earth. But then came, eventually, X-Men First Class. Now, a lot of that kind of stuff is motivated not by the need to tell a story, but the need for a studio to keep the rights to the property.
Right.
So they need to put out something.
That's how you get Amazing Spider-Man.
Well, that's how you get Spider-Man. And that was the other thing I wanted to mention was, like, there are times when it feels like your franchise can be successful and ongoing and self-sustaining, even if it's really not very successful and no one likes it. Like, I mean, I am a defender of the Mark Webb Spider-Man movies. I like those movies. I like Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone enough that I have really enjoyed those movies. I have been
You're going to enjoy them 50% less.
I have been
going forward.
Be quiet. I have been on the lonely road of defending those movies, even though a lot of people are against them. But despite the fact that my opinion of liking them is clearly in the non-majority, they continue to be made. They continue to make a ton of money. They are doing perfectly fine, even though they appear to have been embraced by no one except me.
Yep. I'll walk with you halfway down that road.
Yeah. Well, again, I'd be interested to hear what all of you have to say about franchises. Come and find us and let us know what you think. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, I'm going to start with some blatant NPR promotion, as is sometimes my wont. This episode is coming out the day after Christmas. What a great way to spend your gift certificate money than by using the NPR Book Concierge. Mm-hmm. If you're a book person, even I, as someone who is not a voracious reader, have been poking around in this thing. If nothing else, the interface is just unbelievably beautiful.
Yep.
But it is this wonderful guide to NPR's favorite books of the year. It's searchable in all these different ways. It's a labor of love and labor.
Yes, that is exactly what it is. And some of our favorite people, we should point out, have contributed to it. Our friend Barry Hardiman has contributed to
Petra Mayer.
Petra Mayer has contributed to it. Our friend Margaret Willison did some picture books for them in particular.
The great Beth Novi.
The great Beth Novi worked on this. The great Nicole Cohen worked on this. A bunch of our friends on the visuals team. This is a really excellent project. I agree with Steve.
It is a wonderful tool. I really highly recommend it. Quick NPR Music plug. If you or someone you love is in a band, NPR Music is having a contest to find an unknown or unsigned band to perform a tiny desk concert. One of the things that is making me happy is they are not asking me to judge it.
Mm-hmm.
They have this panel of distinguished performers, like really cool musicians like Reggie Watts, and they're making Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton judge it, but I get to hang back and just see which bands are good.
Yes.
And finally, just hot off the presses, I finally started watching Sherlock.
Right,
I'm only many, many, many years late. I have Netflix now, and I'm like, oh, look, Sherlock. I've been meaning to watch that show. Oh, they only have 9 episodes. I had no idea that there were only 9 episodes. The pace at which I usually watch these things, I should get done with those 9 episodes around 2035 or whenever the new season is supposed to start.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Black Mirror is a British anthology series from Channel 4, which is now available on Netflix streaming. The title, Black Mirror, refers to the screens around us, computers, cell phones, TV. It's an hour-long series, sort of like The Twilight Zone. Each episode is different, a different story. It riffs on technology. So it's science fiction, but it's really about technology as opposed to spaceships or whatever. What's great about it is how richly and deeply imagined it is, how the producers take the tech of today and just sort of nudge it forward maybe 5 years, 10 years, that's it. But they keep it so grounded in human behavior, human interaction, human characters, and make it really recognizable. Now, like a lot of classic science fiction, it's a humanist at heart, but it's also kind of declinist at heart, which means it has this sense of what is this technology doing to us. To the extent it does it, like a lot of classic science fiction, it can be a little didactic sometimes, but it is never shrill in the way that a lot of American television that deals with technology can be shrill. I'm talking here about your Laws and Orders, your CSIs, any police procedural. There's this understanding of technology that, you know, your great aunt has. That's how they approach it.
Nothing against great aunts.
Nothing against great aunts, of course. But, you know, it's like, oh, our suspect is a computer hacker who, oh my God, he plays first-person shooters. It's like that stuff where it comes from a place of fear and not understanding. So it's so refreshing to watch television and see it grappling with tech from a place of understanding and not fear, which means it understands that it has a potential to be a disruptive force. It's not like glorifying it. The whole point of the show is that it has this potential. The storytelling is really great. The first episode's kind of sardonic. It's kind of bleak. It might be a little much for some people, but keep going because it's really, really great. That's Black Mirror on Netflix streaming.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Bob Mondello, what is making you happy this week, sir?
You folks had me on a couple of months ago talking about Toronto, and I did my imitation, and I've brought along, if Jessica will play it for me, the real thing. That is Tim Spall playing J.M.W. Turner in Mr. Turner, a extraordinary picture. And he snorts his way through the entire film. That's not the only examples of it. That's the only ones that were on the clip that they gave us. But it's a remarkable performance. And the lighting in this movie is so gorgeous. And what I'm happy about is that it's finally out there in theaters so that people can see this beautiful thing that I saw months ago and haven't been able to talk to anybody about because you can't show it to them. Anyway, it's out there. It's just gorgeous. There isn't a frame of it that couldn't be framed. It's so beautiful.
Good news for Timothy Spall, of course. He did earlier win the Best Actor Prize from the New York Film Critics Circle and maybe some other ones. I have not kept up with all of the film critic circles, but I know that was the first one I remember hearing.
His reaction was, "Humph!"
Yes, yeah. I'm sure it was. Thank you, Bob Mondello. Well, in addition to Into the Woods, the other film that is getting a Christmas release this year, the other musical, is Annie. And Annie, the remake, stars Quvenzhané Wallace as Annie and Jamie Foxx as the equivalent of Daddy Warbucks. Now, the music from the new Annie has been circulating for quite a while. The album has been available. I bought it on Amazon when it was first out to kind of get a feel for what it sounded like. Where Into the Woods retains most of the music, Annie does not. So one of the things that this got me doing was going back to the cast album from the Broadway Annie that I used to listen to when I was a little girl. Now, Bob is making a funny face, but
because
you have
to...
Because
if she plays this, it's going to be stuck in my head forever.
But you have to know that for the... I mean, I was born in 1970, so this... I was right in the sweet spot of this, like, late 70s, early 80s Annie thing that happened. We had the cast album. I knew everything on this record. And when I went back to listen to the Broadway Annie, one of the things that I remembered about it is that it has this really funny, weird class conscious stuff that happens. There's a whole song essentially about Herbert Hoover plunging people into poverty and doing nothing for them. And there are some very cutting lines about Hoover and about the Depression.
We'd like to thank you, Herbert Hoover, for really showing us the way. We'd like to thank you, Herbert Hoover. You made us what we are today. Prosperity was round the corner. The cozy cottage meant for two. In this new heaven that you gave us, yes, return.
I had forgotten a lot of that stuff and how it plays against the fact that obviously it's kind of a wealth fantasy where she goes off and lives with this rich guy. And I had forgotten that the people who wrote that show built in kind of this undercurrent of class struggle and class consciousness, and that ultimately there is a real salute to FDR and the New Deal, and that FDR putting together the New Deal is one of the climactic triumphs in this show. And so for me, going back and listening to some of the music in Annie, which I had not listened to in a very long time, was really a profound pleasure. it was really a joy, and I enjoyed it very, very much.
Are you going to play the music going out?
Maybe so. Maybe we'll get a little Annie. Yeah, at any rate, that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Bob at Bob _ Mondello. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica _ Reedy. That's REEDY. And our producer, Emeritus and Music Director, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you may or may not be tapping your head to right now, unless it's Annie. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
It was a joy.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour this year. We have a holiday treat, a preview of Invisibilia, NPR's newest show. Invisibilia looks at the invisible forces that shape human behavior, like the impulse to put things into categories or the meaning of dark thoughts. From the people who created This American Life and Radiolab, look for Invisibilia on iTunes under podcasts. Subscribe and be the first to hear full episodes of Invisibilia on January 9th. Listen.